The Americanization of Canada's Military, a talk delivered by Stephen Staples of the Polaris Institute on Thursday, January 26, 2006. Organized by the Society for Corporate, Environmental, and Social Responsibility, the Nova Scotia Voice of Women for Peace, and the Halifax Peace Coalition, the Americanization of Canada's Military was recorded and produced in the studios of CKDU-FM, Halifax, by Candace Moores. Stephen Staples is the Director of Security Programs for the Polaris Institute, a public interest research organization based in Ottawa. The Polaris Institute is widely credited as playing a key role in preventing the Canadian government from joining the U.S. Missile Defense Program in 2005. Stephen Staples is a frequent contributor to journals, magazines, and conferences, and is often called upon to comment on defense and public policy-related issues by the national and international news media. His years of work with popular organizations, including the Council of Canadians, has made him well known among civil society organizations, and he speaks regularly to audiences in Canada and the United States and around the world. This talk is entitled The Americanization of Canada's Military. It was presented at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia.
I want to thank the Center for Foreign Policy Studies for inviting me back. I guess the last presentation went okay a few years ago, because I wasn't sure if I was going to get invited back or not. But it's a pleasure and really an honor to come to be able to present to such a knowledgeable crowd. There's a tremendous amount of expertise here in the Foreign Policy Studies department here. And of course, I'm always following the research that's coming out of here and using that in my own work. So I hope that we have a really good kind of cross-fertilization happening today. My presentation will probably be from a little bit different perspective than most presentations here, but it's always my intention to make sure that we're all agreeing on the facts and the substance, and but we can have a good debate about the interpretation and the future directions of where we want our Canadian forces to go. So what I thought I'd do is spend I guess I've got maybe about 40 minutes or so going over a few ideas, a few observations, a little bit of analysis, and I really hope that we can get into a good discussion afterward about the presentation, and I really do want to hear your impressions of it. So we've titled the presentation today, The Americanization of the Canadian Military. And, you know, it's a catchy title, and it's meant to convey a point. And the point, I think, is that the role of the Canadian Forces is changing. The culture is changing, I think, as well. And there are people that are trying to transform the Canadian military in a way that I think that most Canadians have no idea where it's going. And I'll close with a plea that Canadians do need to be engaged with the direction that and the decisions that are being made about the Canadian Forces. And this will be familiar to you. I think we essentially, Canadians, I'm talking about the public, have two visions of what our military does. The first is this one, the Blue Beret or the Blue Helmet, working with the United Nations, doing peacekeeping, offering an open hand to, in this case, a child, someone who needs help, okay? Working through multilateral institutions like the United Nations. This is the vision that most Canadians hold of what the Canadian Forces do. But there's another vision emerging, and it's being promoted, especially in policy circles, within the military, within Ottawa, I find, even within CEO boardrooms. And it's this one, a Canadian as a sniper, hiding out, picking off people in Afghanistan, okay? Secretly, perhaps it's the special forces or a commando that's involved. And it's war fighting capability, much more warlike. Two different visions of the Canadian Forces that are being put forward. And I think Canadians are much more familiar with the first one, but many people are wanting to move our forces towards the second. Well, let's look at the background of this. Where has this drive for the Americanization of the Canadian Forces come from? What is the impetus? Now, it's true that cooperating for North American security is one of the central tenets of the 1994 White Paper, and always has been, that cooperation is important. That is a no-brainer that we need to do that. But there have been tremendous new pressures to go much further beyond that, especially after 9/11. And President George Bush, shortly after the attacks on New York, issued this challenge to foreign capitals around the world. Either you're with us or you're with the terrorists. And this was a signal to all allies to say that you must acknowledge there is only one remaining superpower in the world, and the U.S. is it. We are the leaders in commerce and military, and you have to decide where you stand. Are you with us or are you with the terrorists? And this message was clearly received. D&D analysts writing the annual strategic review in the months, in the weeks following September 11th, added this analysis onto it in the epilogue, said traditional U.S. allies will find that calls for military, diplomatic, and other support from Washington will be regarded as a test of their loyalty. Again, are you with us or are you with the terrorists? So this began a tremendous push to help the United States and build in what some people have described as a fortress North America, that there would be a security perimeter all the way around the entire continent. And what does this involve? Well, certainly it involves pressure from the United States to increase military spending. Let's remind ourselves when Paul Cellucci, the U.S. ambassador, came to Canada. What were his instructions? Did he have a long list of issues that he needed to raise with the Canadian legislators? No. There was only one thing that he was told by Colin Powell to do when he got to Canada, was to get us to increase military spending. I mean, can you imagine? And all the environmental, resource, water, fisheries, all kinds of issues that are at play, trade in terms of Canada-U.S. relationship. The only instruction the U.S. ambassador got was to increase, get Canada to increase military spending. And I would say he was very successful at that. I think we would all agree he was very successful at achieving that. And we'll get into that a little bit later. Certainly buying U.S.-built military equipment. Is it any surprise that the sole source contract for tactical airlift was suddenly geared towards buying Lockheed Martin C-130Js? Is that any surprise that we would go with an American firm? I'm not saying that it's not a good airplane, but the fact that it was rushed into play and that these are American carriers, also the replacements for the helicopters, for the Sea Kings, again, American firm. So it's not just an economic or commercial pressure, it's also we have to buy equipment that is interoperable with U.S. forces. We need to be able to talk to one another, we need to be able to share data, we need to be able to drop the same bombs that they do. And so it's pressure to buy that gold standard, incredibly expensive equipment. Third, we need to join U.S.-led missions. And I'm sure everyone here will know that we can, if it's a mistake to think that we can just give the Americans what they want in terms of North American security and sit out wars around the world. Because in the American view, there's no distinction. The invasion of Iraq was about defending North America. So in George Bush's view, homeland security often requires fighting a war in someone else's homeland. That's what homeland security is about. So whether it be in Afghanistan or other foreign missions, that is all counted as a contribution to North American security. The debate has been very interesting that we've seen in the last few years in Canada. Essentially, we have seen an alliance form between the defense lobby and the corporate lobby. The defense lobby in Ottawa is probably fairly familiar to us, the retired military staff that populate the various think tanks, much of it funded by the Department of National Defense itself, the various conservative other associations. We would have also the industry lobby from Defense Industries Association, even aspects of the Aerospace Industry Association. There's new organizations popping up all the time. That I would say it's not, there's no membership card in this, but it is a block of opinion, of lobby and pressure on the government. Now, there's the corporate lobby is slightly different, related, but different. This is the lobby that brought in free trade, that is focused more on the commercial side of the relationship with the United States, that looks for expanding globalization and maintaining market access into the United States. Now, because security trumps trade, as the U.S. ambassador told us, that has formed the basis of an alliance between those people who want to trade with the Americans and keep the borders open. They see their interest being the same as the defense lobby that are pushing for greater military cooperation and interoperability and beefed up, more robust Canadian forces. They have a linkage there. Missile defense was a perfect example of this, where you had the CEOs of Bay Street pushing for missile defense. Now, do you think that, CEO Bay Street and CEOs from Toronto, really believe there's a missile threat to Canada or are concerned about the proliferation of missile technology? No, I don't think so. So why were they pushing for missile defense? Well, because George Bush wanted it. And he's our biggest trading partner, so we give George what he wants. That's the basic calculation there. So that's why they were pushing for missile defense. Well, let's just break this down. It's a tremendous pressure, obviously coming from the so-called Vulcans in the Bush administration through their proxies here in Washington. And we talked about Paul Cellucci, and now we're getting to know our new U.S. ambassador here in Canada, who had some interesting things to say about Arctic sovereignty today in the news. There are other allies here in Canada. Tom Tocchino, who's the head of the Canadian Council of Chief Executives. This is the corporate body. Tocchino is one of the chief architects of free trade, great proponent of globalization. And one of his key partners in bringing in the free trade agreement was a guy named Derek Burney. Who's Derek Burney? Well, Derek Burney was the former chief of staff of Brian Mulroney, Canadian ambassador to Washington, boasts about his role in bringing in free trade. Well, Derek Burney, after leaving public life, went in to head CAE, Canada's largest Canadian-owned defense corporation, and became a main proponent for missile defense, very active in the Canadian Council of Chief Executives, up until very recently when he left CAE. But as of this week, we know he has a new job. Does anyone know what Derek Burney's doing?
He has a transition year advisor for Stephen Harper.
That's right. And only 2 weeks ago, he was sitting in front of government committees pushing for Canada to go back to the table on missile defense. And I was on a panel with him just 2 weeks ago at the University of Ottawa, and he hasn't changed his tune one bit. Irascible fellow, and certainly very effective. So I found him a very persuasive arguer, and now he's got the ear of Stephen Harper, and he will be a good spokesperson for the defense lobby, corporate lobby alliance. Then there's other people. Here's Patty O'Donnell from the Canadian Conference of Defense Associations. Rick Hillier's former boss, and now one of the lead lobbyists for the purchase of military aircraft that are going to be sole source, possibly. So these guys are backed up by the media elites as well. I mean, can you think of even one Canadian English language newspaper that was opposed to Canada joining missile defense? I mean, the best I could come up with, maybe the Hill Times. That was it. Every other paper, including the Toronto Star, was in favor of joining missile defense, which the National Post wrote an editorial congratulating the Toronto Star for finally seeing, the wisdom of joining missile defense. But what a disjuncture between what the newspapers were saying but what was being said on Main Street, what Canadian popular opinion was. Because when the decision came down to not join missile defense, Decima did a poll, fairly detailed poll on Canadians' support or non-support for that decision. Majority supported it in every province, including Alberta. I want to make sure Jack Grant, if someone knows Jack Grantstein, be sure to tell him that. That a majority in Alberta as well as Quebec supported the decision to not join missile defense. But it crosses party lines. Here we have Senator Colin Kenney, you know, who's got his own outfit going in the his defense committee in the Senate. And he pushes very hard for this as well. I think he's also an effective lobbyist. And of course, the pressure is coming onto the government now, and with the new Harper government. And we'll get to Stephen Harper a little bit later. Now, they have been trying to influence Canadian policy, and I think they have a mixed track record, because for the last history of the minority government, and even before that, they have not achieved everything that they wanted. So they're not all powerful. Let's look at some of the key decisions that have been made. Certainly, we said yes to the invasion of Afghanistan, and of course, we're still there today. 2,000 troops are on their way again. But we said no to the 2003 invasion of Iraq, Fred Chan writing his legacy. We also said no to missile defense in 2005. Not a decision that Paul Martin wanted to make, but one that he, in the end, had no choice. And we can talk about this, because I think a great contributing factor to the no decision on missile defense was the position of Stephen Harper and the Conservatives in the last parliament. And we can talk about that a little bit more, too. But at the same time, in fact, practically the same week that we said no to missile defense in 2005, we said yes to that demand that I mentioned earlier, military spending increases and military transformation. Huge military spending increases in the 2005 budget. Let's have a look at military spending, because I think this is a good indicator of the overall direction of where we're moving. 2005-2006 military spending was at $14.68 billion. I'm not talking about budget, I'm talking about the total number of dollars actually being spent. Okay. Where does this put us? Only 7% below spending at the end of the Cold War. So a lot of people have said, oh, well, you know, we let the spending drop at the end of the Cold War, and now it's time to put it back. Well, quite frankly, we have put it back. The peace dividend has been clawed back over the last years, much of it put back since the late 1990s when we started posting budget surpluses. And I'll chart that for you here in a second, too. We are one of the highest spenders in NATO in real dollars already, even without the big budget spending increases in budget 2005. We went back and looked at the NATO spending estimates that were put out in June of last year, and this is what we found in terms of real dollars. Where does Canada rank on the list? 26 members of NATO. Put Russia in there. Number 7. 7th highest, 26 members of NATO. Fairly respectable position, actually. In fact, we spend more than the bottom 12 combined. We're in the ranks with the other middle powers. And, of course, the United States is at the top. I mean, they spend as much as the rest of the world combined, for crying out loud. So they're in a league of their own. These other guys also have to pay for expensive nuclear weapons systems, which we don't. So there's higher levels there. But you'll see that we are quickly approaching the Russian Federation level of spending with these budget increases. We'll soon be spending more than our former Cold War foe at the rate things are going. Okay, I want to just address a little issue here. This is a bit of an aside. But amongst many people, they think that the defense spending increases are required to address the salaries of military personnel. But when you actually talk to personnel, you know, that's not one of the complaints. It's certainly true. There was an appalling condition during the 1990s. Don't dispute that. Military personnel were going through a long wage freeze. That can't be said as well for the senior brass of the military, who were enjoying some pretty good increases during the 1990s, but not to the regular folk. But let's just look at where we are right now. A new recruit, 18 years old, joining the military today, will earn roughly around $29,000 a year. Not too bad, but let's compare it. Okay, so if he or she's 18 years old, probably a lot of his peers are probably working in the sales and service industry, right? They're at the mall, they're in, you know, fast food. This is well, how much? What's the average wage for that? Well, it's 26 and a half per year, which is not too bad. And certainly you see someone going into the military is earning well above their peers in the sales and service area. But let's fast forward for 3 years, okay? This recruit's in his or her third year in the Canadian Forces, 20 years old. They're earning $42,000 a year. Well, how does that rank with the, well, let's say, with the, what's the national average? So the national average of all full-time workers in Canada is $40,000 per year. 20-year-old recruit, third year in the Canadian Forces, earning more than the average of all full-time workers in Canada. That's not too shabby. And of course, you'll see, if you go look at the other pay bonuses that are involved, if you have a skill, if you're coming in at the higher end, if you have a trade, or if you're a doctor, for example, that there's tremendous bonuses. And of course, this doesn't include all of the other perks that are available. You know, this is just straight salary. So let's just dispel this notion that increase in defense spending is needed to deal with this particular problem. And let's give Art Eggleton credit where it's due, because I think he really did care about this and made these changes when he was defense minister. Now, let's get to budget 2005. What happened last year? $12.8 billion the Liberals put in with the approval of the NDP over 5 years. Where does that put us? Increase of 34% by the end of the decade. Ralph Goodale bragged that it was the largest defense increase in 20 years. Well, what did one of the chief defense lobby organizations have to say about it? Were they happy? They've certainly been crying for years that defense spending had to go up. What did the Conference of Defense Associations say? It's staggering, they said. It's staggering, was their reaction to budget 2005. Very large increases going in. So by comparison, in budget 2005, other announcements that were made in that same budget, let's just look and see where the priority went in that budget. The Liberals announced $5 billion for childcare, $2.7 billion for seniors, $1 billion for greenhouse gas reductions, $3.4 billion for aid, $12.8 billion for the military. So where do you think the priority was going within the government for increased spending? Very clearly, the military was winner, hands down, over the environment, over seniors, over the much-touted childcare program that was brought in. But a lot of the focus is on these issues, but this is where the real action was happening in the last budget. All of these figures, by the way, are over 5 years, so we can compare them. Let's chart this a bit. Again, adjusting all figures to current dollars, so we're comparing apples with apples here. Let's look at what spending's been doing. 1980 was the big military buildup. Actually, it wasn't under Mulroney, it was under Trudeau. A lot of the money came in. When Mulroney came in the big 80s, he certainly made his own increases right up until 1990 when the Berlin Wall fell. Peace dividend comes in. All governments around the world begin reducing military spending. In fact, the United States reduced theirs far more than Canada did, and we did not keep up with the international average of spending reductions. But we see the peace dividend being brought in the 1980s. Now, for many people, they had hoped that we tolerated high military spending during the Cold War because we were squaring off against the Ruskies, you know, from Dr. Strangelove. And we were going toe-to-toe with them. So we had to spend all this money because there was an imminent threat against our country. But with that threat gone, a lot of Canadians wanted that money for social programs. Did it go to social programs? Not really. It was during the debt and deficit reduction period. It did go to deficit reduction, largely measures during the 1990s. But then the government started posting budget surplus. Paul Martin at the helm of the finance Department of Finance began posting budget surpluses. Okay, moonlighting soldiers as pizza delivering pizzas at night. These stories start coming out. Defense spending starts going up a little bit at a time. It has been steadily increasing up until this year, to the point that we're just 7% below what we were spending when the Cold War fell. So much of that money has already been put back. The budget 2005 comes along. $12.8 billion over 5 years. What does that do to our graph? Off the scale! $13 billion over 5 years. You can barely even measure it on here. We're going to surpass $20 billion by the end of the decade. That's why Howie Marsh said it's staggering. Because it is staggering when you look at it in terms of real dollars of what the budget is doing. Let's zoom in on that a little bit. We're at $14.6 billion now. We'll be at over $20 billion. What did Stephen Harper say? He said he's going to implement these increases and add $5 billion onto the top of it. So we'll actually be up around here somewhere by the end of the decade. I'm going to have to do a new chart. So under the Liberal plan, $20 billion by 2009-2010. We'll be over $25 billion if the Conservatives have their way, although they are in a minority. But that's their plan. Highest, the budget will be the highest since the Second World War. We'll be spending more than we did during the Cold War. you know, when we were facing off against Russian ICBMs. Now, how many ICBMs does Al-Qaeda have? Do they have nuclear submarines off patrolling off the coast? I don't know. But yet we're spending as much money to defend ourselves from Al-Qaeda as we did against the Russians, for crying out loud. So what is this money going to? Well, I would argue is we're in the period of transformation. I mean, we all hear transformation this, transformation that. We're all about transformation these days. I don't know what happened to the Revolution of Military Affairs. I guess that fell out of vogue, and now we're into transformation now. This is just another term imported from the Pentagon. These are terms that have been brought in, championed by Paul Wolfowitz and Donald Rumsfeld, who right after September 11th set up the Department of Force Transformation in the Pentagon. Arthur Sobrowski, who just recently died, was put at the head of that department. And now Canada, 5 years later, we're all about transformation too. And of course, Rick Hilliard, Chief of Defense Staff, was brought in. And you know, I want to remind people, that was a choice. The government chose Rick Hilliard. It wasn't his turn. He wasn't standing next in line. There was a reason he was brought in. It was because of his experience in the United States. He understood the U.S. military. He had held very high posts within the U.S. military as an exchange officer. He had a particular vision that the government wanted to implement this transformation. And Rick Hilliard has been very clear about where he thinks we should be going. Our job is to be able to kill people. You know, that's the point of the military in his view, and that's what we're going to be transforming our military towards. These are detestable murderers and scumbags, and we're not going to let them rob from Canada. So he's been very clear on, you know, he's a straight shooter, and there's no dispute about that. And in some ways, I think that the government has been encouraging him to be the front on this, and to lead this charge, even publicly. Perhaps even coming close to maybe crossing a line between, you know, a role of a chief of defense staff and then getting into policy. But this is something that the government seems to be willing to go along with. So we're transforming our forces into one that's more capable of doing war fighting with the United States. Certainly the mobile gun system. Come on, it's got a 105-millimeter tank turret loaded on this sucker. It's as big as an M1 tank. It's the same, loaded the same firepower. You don't need that for peacekeeping, I don't think. And whether it's wheels or tanks, tank treads on it, I mean, we can get into that, but I think we're really talking about firepower here. Smart bombs. We are now testing out new smart bombs in Cold Lake, several $100 million being allocated for upgrading our CF-18s just to be able to use this type of weaponry. The Chief of the Air Staff testified before the Commons Defense Committee, said this was a prime capability needed to be able to deploy with the United States. We need them if we want to do shock and awe. If we're going to play with the big guys and doing shock and awe campaigns, we're going to have to use the same types of munitions, the same types of targeting equipment, so we're going to get the pods and the whole thing to go along with it. And this, pardon the pun, keeps floating around out there. This, the conservatives called it some kind of hybrid carrier. The liberals, you know, beat them over the head with it in the last election, then turned around and said, all right, we're going to get a hybrid carrier. They don't call it that. But it's some form of amphibious assault ship. And I'm not confusing this with the joint supply ships. That's something different. This is, as Rick Hilliard, in his technical way of describing it, called it a big honking ship. And this is, I think that this is a photo of the Tarawa. It's just one possible variant that we could be buying. Actually, I don't even think the Americans even build this class anymore. They have a new class coming up. This is San Antonio classes. I think that has actually been ruled out as too expensive for the Canadians. But there's lots of other variants of amphibious assault ships. The idea is not so much aircraft, although, you know, again, you're going to have to look at the list of capabilities. Are we going to include the Joint Strike Fighter, you know, variants on this? I don't know. But certainly the Chinooks that we're planning to buy will be able to be deployed on this, and I think these are Chinooks right there. And as well, there will be a well in the back that will be able to have amphibious capability that we can deploy troops and material right off the ship, you know, sort of kind of doing this D-Day type landing affair on it. Probably only buying one. Price tag? Who knows? Unknown at this point. Depends on how many capabilities you want to weld onto this thing. And the price will start going up. Notice there's been very little discussion about this. I think that the Liberals were very worried about this, and it doesn't really appear much even in the media. I don't even think, did Stephen Harper even talk about this capability? I don't think he did. But yet plans are underway to bring this in. Of course, lots of naval folks here know that we regularly deploy with U.S. aircraft carrier battle groups or carrier battle groups. And here we have a small, I think this is the Kennedy, I'm not sure. Certainly a U.S. carrier, a replenish ship, and a Canadian patrol frigate. And we're regularly deploying out there with these configurations. Normally for the non-military people here, normally there may be a few other U.S. ships involved as well, and probably a nuclear submarine lurking around underneath as well, too. And this to do this, you have to have systems that are completely compatible across the system here. You can't be using a Mac over here and an IBM over here. The systems have to be able to talk to one another. And I think another issue that has not been raised is the cooperative engagement capability that is being discussed, where you can actually have the ability to target and fire weapon systems on a Canadian ship at the decision of the U.S. commander for the carrier group. This is something that the Americans are bringing in. You know, it's involved in the Aegis-class ships. And this is something, a capability that undoubtedly Canadian ships, if we want to continue to do this, and certainly the Navy wants to, this will be something that will have to be brought in. Here we have Papa Bear, Mama Bear, and Baby Bear. Other programs that I think are quite clearly designed to improve the interoperability of our forces, $150 million U.S. on the Joint Strike Fighter program. We don't even plan to buy these planes. And in fact, probably by the time we need to replace the CF-18s, there won't even be pilots in aircraft anymore. They'll all be unmanned. But yet we're still pumping all of this money going into the Joint Strike Fighter program, basically to try to win contracts. $1 billion on submarines. I know everyone trots out fisheries patrol and, you know, all surveillance and sovereignty and things like that, but let's be real. Why did we buy the submarines? It's true, the defense minister said it himself, it's because the Americans wanted us to buy them. They need them for training, for anti-submarine warfare capability. For those who don't know, the Americans have an all-nuclear-powered submarine fleet, and they're a lot noisier than the diesel-electric kind that we have traditionally used. And of course, the Russians have diesel-electric submarines, so they need to do training. And so that's why we rushed out and bought these submarines. They're not used for peacekeeping. You can't use them for fisheries patrol. You can't have fishing nets out there and submarines in the same space. That's crazy. And what are you going to do? You can't get on board a fishing vessel. We have patrol aircraft and we have ships to do that. More money wasted on capability that we don't need, that is desperately needed for other capabilities. We should do that. And as I mentioned, $2.6 billion on CF-18 upgrade, including laser-guided bombs. The CF-18s were bought, I know they're multi-purpose, but they were bought primarily as an air defense platform for NORAD. I think that's reasonable. There's no, I don't think in the age when people are flying airplanes into buildings in North America, NORAD actually got a new lease on life. But why are we equipping them with this expeditionary capability to be able, you know, putting the targeting pods on them, we're putting smart bombs on them, we're loading them up so they can fly great long distances and bomb people? I don't think that's a role for the CF-18s. Of course, the proving ground for warfighting with America is shaping up to be in Afghanistan. And it's a very sad day today. It's the funeral of Glenn Berry, the diplomat who was killed in the recent bombing in Afghanistan. And at the same time, as you'll notice in news reports, we're now beginning to deploy 2,000 troops to Afghanistan under the auspices of the U.S. and NATO. The government has reminded us that this is not a peacekeeping mission, and also to prepare for casualties. Have Canadians heard this message? I don't think so. I don't think Canadians have any idea what's happening. And I don't think they're going to be prepared for casualties. I mean, just look at the attention that's been played on three wounded soldiers when Glenn Berry was killed. You know, we've got the media following the families, going to Germany. You know, it's like we're getting daily updates on the conditions of the soldiers. That kind of thing doesn't happen in the United States. You know, they don't even publicize. There's no photos of coffins coming back. It's all tightly controlled, but Canadians respond differently. And I think this is going to be a problem for the government. And of course, we are part of a force that will be relieving 4,000 U.S. troops, not a large number when you talk about how many are in the region, But we are relieving 4,000 U.S. troops who will be headed to Iraq, along with the British and Dutch troops. What's happening in Afghanistan? Canadian commandos are cooperating with U.S. forces under U.S. command. We're part of Operation Enduring Freedom. We're fighting alongside the Americans, special commandos. And here we have that photograph of JTF-2 soldiers taking Taliban prisoners. What happens to these prisoners? Where do they go? Where do they end up? Do we have our own prisons? Are they brought back to Canada for trial? No, we hand them over to the Americans. And they've ended up in Abu Ghraib. And they've ended up in Guantanamo Bay. And it's a result of Canadian actions, handing them over to the Americans in violation of international law. We have treaties against that kind of treatment. We've signed agreements that we won't take part in that kind of thing. But yet, this is what fighting with the Americans involves. We play by their rules in Afghanistan, and that seems to be what Canada is doing. And I want to raise an increasing disturbing trend. I want to ask the question, are we seeing the development of a secret army within our own military? With the expansion and the reliance on JTF-2 and other secret commandos, and, you know, there's different levels that are now being brought in. Harper wants to bring back the airborne. Because anytime these guys are involved in anything, the government refuses to release any information and says it's all about national security. Recently, 3 JTF-2 commandos were wounded. And the timeline is, I don't know how long, but eventually we found out that they were involved in a firefight with U.S. commandos. Prisoners were taken, and 3 Canadians were wounded. How did we learn that? Was it from a press briefing at D&D headquarters? Was it from our defense minister? No. We learned it from a press conference at the Pentagon. Because the Pentagon actually released more information than the Canadian government did. And because it was a joint operation, that's how we actually learned what happened to the JTF-2 commandos. And so as in the war on terrorism, commandos are the front lines. And some people have actually argued you can see a shift in our Air Force and our Navy and in the land forces to begin to just be a supporting role, playing a supporting role for the increasing use of secret commandos. But we don't know because the government, top secret, you know, it just goes under the wraps. We know that millions of dollars were spent on new arms purchases for JTF-2. And again, that was deemed top secret. So who knows what the rules were, what the contracting rules, what we were buying, who we bought it from. Again, national security. As I mentioned, the Afghanistan, the combat operations that we're involved in, government's releasing no information on it. We have to get it from the Pentagon. Top secret. And the latest one, you know, it is laughable, this missile defense. You've seen Dave Pulasey, a reporter for the Ottawa Citizen, did a piece recently saying that access to information documents that are coming out of DND are now redacting information that's available on missile defense agency websites. For example, the government considers the location of the missile defense interceptors a secret. Well, everyone knows they're in Alaska and they're in California. It's widely reported. But this, again, is top secret. Are we developing some kind of secret military within our own? And I have to point out that what is the common thread between these? What is determined the most top secret and sensitive part of this information? It's where the Canadian forces are being integrated with U.S. forces. This is where the overlap is occurring, and this is where the veil secrecy is being dropped down. Okay, election 2006, Tory Minority. Let's have a look at what we've got in store here. Of course, it's exactly clear. Stephen didn't get his majority, but let's look at his platform. Certainly, he's going to implement the Liberal program and increase this, plus an additional $5.3 billion over 5 years, as I mentioned, clearly over $20 billion by the end of the decade, over $25 billion by the end of the decade. What else did he talk about? Bringing back the airborne battalion. Wow, what a flashback, you know? It's the 1980s and all over again, and so more commando style, but I think this was really a throwback to the hardcore within the Conservative Party that were so upset that Jean Chrétien disbanded the airborne over the Somalia. The darkest moment in the Canadian Forces' recent history was Somalia. Not just the incident itself, but the shameful cover-ups, the highest levels of leadership within the Canadian forces to keep details of that incident away from the Canadian public. I can't for the life of me understand why Stephen Harper wants to bring that back, but that's certainly, I think, a symbolic direction of where the government, new government intends to move. Strategic transport, certainly an issue that's been out there. So by C-17s made by Boeing, another U.S. Contractor. Certainly we'll be looking at these. These are great for hauling around tanks. And, you know, you can fit your attack helicopters on these things. This is a capability that's highly prized by the Pentagon, being able to deploy lethal force very rapidly. And, of course, without a lot of assistance of neighboring countries, you can get them right in there very fast. And so having this capability will certainly be of assistance to the U.S. military, so the Canadians will have their own strategic lift capability. But of course, you know, one's not enough. You can't just have one plane because you've got to service them. So we'll have two. Oh, why two? Let's have three. Why not four? We'll have four C-17s to cart around the Canadian military. Now, lots of people say, well, yeah, you know, you can carry food aid on them too. Well, you know, you can carry lollipops on them, for all I care. The point is, that's not what they're for. They're for carrying tanks and aircraft, heavy military equipment, and that's what they're going to be used for. Price tag? $2 billion at least, to maintain a fleet of four of these aircraft. Now, he's going to shave the number of Hercules, I think, is the plan. Cut down the number of Hercules replacements that we'll do, try to get this in there. But let me make a prediction right now, because I think if we do buy these, we're not going to be using them very much. They're going to be sitting on the tarmac, I bet, quite a bit down at Trenton. And so what is the government going to do? They're going to start looking around for possible leasers. Yeah, you know, because everybody wants strategic airlift, maybe we can rent these out. So I'll bet in a year from now, we'll see, or a year and a half from now, we'll see Canadian C-17s transporting U.S., Australian, or maybe Italian forces to Iraq. Even though we didn't join, but again, we'll see our equipment being used to help a war that we didn't do. Just a prediction, write it down, come back in a couple years, and you can tell me if I was right or wrong. Okay, here's a good one, Arctic defense. During the election, oh, a U.S. submarine. Suddenly everyone realized U.S. submarines are under the ice up north. Well, I mean, this has always been happening, but it did make a bit of a splash during the election. So Stephen Harper came out with a new plan to deal with these American submarines, icebreakers. Now here's a Canadian Coast Guard icebreaker. All of our icebreakers right now are under the Coast Guard. I mean, we only spent several billion dollars on frigates, and nobody thought that maybe they should have the capability of breaking ice, or maybe a couple of them. But anyway, we've still got a dozen frigates that can't go in the north. So not necessarily a bad idea, and the fact that we do need to have some capability in the north, the Northwest Passage is opening up. But is this is this really a role for the military? Because Stephen Harper didn't just say icebreakers, he said heavily armed icebreakers. So we've got some turrets on there for Stephen, but you know, it's not just arms, he wants them heavily armed. You know, oh, there's still see some room, let's put a whole bunch of turrets all over this. There's Stephen Harper's heavily armed icebreakers that we're gonna have. And why stop at one when you can have two or three? So we're gonna have three heavily armed icebreakers up north to do I don't know what, because we're going to have to spend $3 to $5 billion on this. And of course, that's just the thing we need to stop those American submarines from going around up there. And I just, you know, if you don't ask me, just, you know, I'm reading a quote here from the newspaper yesterday. Defense analyst says here, don't go looking for armed icebreakers on the horizon either. That's way too expensive for the short term, and I think a bit crazy, to be honest. So when Dan Middlemice says that Stephen Harper's plan is a little crazy, I start to get worried. I agree. But here's a low-cost little something that he can do. He can pledge to reopen missile defense. Now, to be fair to Stephen Harper, I don't see much difference between his position today to the one that he did during the missile defense debate, because he has put some caveats on it. He said, first of all, that he will only do this if he gets a formal request from Washington to reopen discussions on missile defense. And I'm sure on Derek Burney's and Alain Pellerin and Jim Ferguson's and on all their Rolodex, you know, right after the election was, call my friends in Bush administration, ask for a request for negotiations. I'm sure lots of faxes are going down to try to get that letter from the Bush administration to reopen negotiations, and Stephen Harper will have to go back to the table. Now, he also said, and he doesn't have to do this, because the decision to join missile defense can be done by the cabinet, and this was always the case. But to be consistent with his position in the last parliament, he can't change this. He says he has to bring the deal back to parliament for a non-binding, it would be a non-binding vote, and a free vote. Now, had he got a majority, I would be a lot more worried than I am right now, because he's facing off against three opposition parties who have more votes than he does, and all three are opposed to missile defense. So, boy, he's in a rough spot. Do you think Stephen Harper wants to get that request from the Bush administration anytime soon? I don't think so, because he could be obliged to satisfy his own promise to start negotiations on a deal that he knows he can't deliver, because he doesn't have the votes in Parliament. Of course, that doesn't stop George Bush. George Bush doesn't seem to be very concerned about the political sensitivities around Canadian prime ministers. You know, my case in point was when he came here to Halifax and said, I can't wait for you to join missile defense. Well, for missile defense opponents like us, we said, thank you very much. That was exactly what we wanted him to say. And that brought down the whole House of Cards within a few months. Missile defense became a huge problem for Paul Martin, and I wonder if it's going to be a huge problem for Stephen Harper as well. Are we aware of the dangers of what's happening in Afghanistan? Right now, I'm talking about the potential costs of this Americanization of the Canadian forces. Is there a clear mission for these 2,000 troops on their way there? Is there public support for it? Does the Canadian public even know what's happening, what they're doing? Is this a Canadian priority, or is this simply an American priority? Because let's be clear, we went to Afghanistan in 2002 because it was an American priority. There's no shortages of countries around the world, failing states, that oppress their own people, that live in poverty. But why Afghanistan and not Sudan? Because Sudan is not a priority for the United States. So that's why we're in. The risk of casualties is huge. And I'm going to get a little bit philosophical here about the social contract. I would say that when a Canadian says, I'm going to join the military and I'm prepared to give my life, the country. That is a very solemn pledge, an oath that must be respected. And there exists a social contract between Canadians through our government with that soldier to say, we will not ask you to do that unless it is the absolute last resort. And we have said this is absolutely crucial for our security and the defense of Canada in order to be able to do that. And we will give you the best equipment in order to be able to do that under the best circumstances. And I have to question, are we living up to that bond, that social contract, with those 2,000 troops that are now on the way to Afghanistan? I snapped this out of the Globe and Mail just a couple days ago. It's suicide bombings, the deadly trend in Afghanistan. The trend of suicide bombings in Iraq is now spreading into Afghanistan. And you know, suicide bombings is not a traditional tactic used in Afghanistan. You know, the Taliban never used that really against the Russians. This is something new that's being brought in. And if you look at the numbers here, in 2002 there were only three suicide bombings. 2003, a pair. 2004, six. 2005, 22. We're seeing a trend develop here. 2006, just within the first couple of weeks, there have been four. So we can see the trend that's happening here. I don't care how many mobile gun systems you've got, how many precision-guided artillery shells you have, they're useless against suicide bombers. So I think that, especially today with the funeral of Glenn Berry, we have to remind ourselves what is possibly in store for these 2,000 Canadian troops that are going to Afghanistan. Other costs. With all our troops committed to this one mission, there's very little left for the United Nations. We have essentially abandoned the UN. For every $10 we spent on international missions, how much was spent on UN-led missions? Okay, the Blue Helmets. In 1992-93, $9.27 for every $10 on international missions went to UN Blue Helmet missions. In 2004-2005, 31 cents. 31 cents go to UN missions. We've abandoned the UN. We've abandoned it. let's go, this is the latest data from December 31st. Let's see what the numbers, okay, that was the cost. How many soldiers? And this actually includes military personnel. Okay, so this includes some of the military people that are in Haiti, not soldiers. Well, okay, but for argument's sake, I'll lump those together. Let's have a look at where we rank. So the UN, every month, publishes a list of the countries from the highest to the lowest of contributors of military and police to UN missions. So let's have a look at the list. Where's Canada? Okay, number one, Bangladesh, Pakistan, Ethiopia, Morocco. Okay, 15, China. Oh, China's above us. Where's Canada? Still going down. 20, Ukraine. Oh, Ireland, Zambia. Zambia's 28th. And where's Canada? 32. There we are. Well, at least you can say we're keeping up with the Americans. They're at 31. But the same number of troops at 387. And as you know, we're about to take some Canadian military personnel to the Golan Heights. And analysts that I've talked to have said we're going to drop down to 50s. We're going to get out of the 50s when we pull out of that mission. That's our commitment. I would argue we're freeloading on the UN. We're freeloading on them. Because there's 60,000 troops out there right now wearing blue helmets that are doing the hard, scratch, dirty job of UN peacekeeping, lot in Africa, that's not on the headlines, doesn't get any media attention, and it actually is making a difference. As the Human Security Report put out by named Andy Mack in UBC put out, said, actually, most UN missions today are very successful. We are reducing the number of wars around the world, and it can be directly attributed to peace-building efforts and peace support operations of the UN. So while we're freeloading on the UN, we're off in Afghanistan. And just by comparison, if we'd taken those 2,000 troops that were in Afghanistan and contributed them to a UN-led mission, we would move quickly right up to within the top 10, again, of contributors. What are the other opportunity costs? Many people lump military spending into larger security envelope of foreign aid and other aspects. Well, how does military spending compare to foreign aid? And I'll admit this is a bit apple and oranges, but let's just have a comparison. For every $1 we spend on foreign aid, military spending is $4. So $4 in military spending for every dollar we spend on making poverty history. We've got $12.8 billion over 5 years for defense, but Paul Martin still refused to go to the 0.7% GDP that actually his father pledged how many decades ago? And we still can't seem to do it. Other lost opportunities. Certainly, we have to look that defense spending does not exist in a vacuum. A government has to look at a number of competing priorities of where dollars go. Every dollar we spend on a tank is a dollar that's not available for an MRI scan. And here for the price of one helicopter, about $178 million each, we bought 28. For the price of just one, I'm not saying buy none, but just one. One helicopter. In terms of the terrible homeless problem, we could build 1,500 homes to house people that are get them off our streets. One helicopter, we bought 28. For the price of two helicopters, well, what is that equal in terms of, you know, when I look at education spending? Two helicopters is the entire annual budget of Dalhousie University. We bought 28, and we're going to buy more. There's a lot more on the way. We're just getting started. So I think that Canadians must reclaim defense policy. And this is one of the things that I've constantly argued, and I'm sure there's a lot of people that would agree with me here, that defense policy and defense spending gets bent and twisted to try to satisfy every special interest and foreign power that comes along. And the primary purpose of it, which is the defense of Canada and promoting international peace and security, seems to keep getting knocked down the list. The defense contractors want their bit. You know, various ridings want their own number of soldiers. They want to increase it. Politicians are willing to do it if they think they can get votes in Atlantic Canada and Vancouver Island. They'll commit hundreds of new troops here to get a few votes to help increase their spending. The Americans are complaining. George Robertson from NATO, he comes here, he complains about military. All these pressures are put on. It seems Canadian interests and our Canadian policy and what our security concerns are seem to get always pushed down to the bottom. I believe we need to freeze military spending. I'm concerned that this massive increase in defense spending is fueling integration with the United States. Fighting with the Americans is incredibly expensive, and this spending is very clearly being devoted to that purpose. So we need to get a handle on what role we want our Canadian forces to pursue. We need to prevent this integration with the Pentagon. We need to review our defense policy and role in the world. For crying out loud, how old was the last white paper? When did we have it? 1994 was the last white paper on defense. And at that time, there was a tremendous amount of public hearings. I was involved with them. I remember them well in terms of engaging Canadians in a discussion about what we wanted our Canadian forces to do. How should they promote our values around the world? And it was the end of the Cold War. And I believe, and I think you probably agree, that today the world is, recent changes in the world are just as significant as they were at the end of the Cold War. It's now time to engage Canadians into, missed my punchline. To include public participation in defining what role we want. And I would agree with the Bloc Québécois. I think they have a very reasonable position saying it doesn't make sense to start pumping billions of dollars into defense until we get that policy straight first. Because if we don't, we may make mistakes. We may waste money on a capability that later we decide we don't want, or maybe we don't need. You know? And so we end up with the situation where we're spread a mile wide and an inch deep, which is, I think, was what happened over the 1990s. Is that we failed to make the hard choices during the 1990s. We tried to satisfy every branch of the military. Everyone had their own pet projects. And we ended up satisfying no one. So let's get focused on what we want our Canadian forces to do. Let's have a made in Canada defense policy and create our own priorities. And then let's properly fund that policy and those priorities. So I'll end there. And I hope that we can have a discussion about what we can do to help achieve these goals. Well, thank you very much.